Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. So last night, President Juncker gave an interview to Sky Sophie Ridge saying that a Brexit deal was still possible. James, is this any more than just more positive mood music?
I think at the moment it's quite hard to tell what's going on for several reasons. One is neither side want to get blamed for no deal. So both sides want to look like they are trying their hardest to get a deal. Secondly, I think both Boris Johnson and Jean-Claude Juncker are kind of natural optimists, and so more inclined to see the glass as half full rather than half empty.
Juncker especially.
But I think there is a kind of, there is obviously some movement, but it's obviously quite a long way away from a worked up plan that the council could sign off on October 16th, 17th. I think the next thing to watch for is the UN General Assembly in New York. Mm. Leo Varadkar was caught on camera yesterday saying at the National Ploughing Championships in Ireland that he's going to New York and he's going to see Boris Johnson on Monday and he hopes to get a deal there. And I think that also tells you something else, that there is now a level of direct... You know, previously, the Irish have always been very on the grounds that, you know, we are not negotiating with the Brits. Article 50 Task Force negotiates with the Brits, we don't. I think that line is becoming a little bit blurred, but I still wouldn't, you know, get your bunting ready and think that a deal is I still think it is odds against the deal, because I think there is still a very long way to go to get there. But I think there is, you know, if there was more, but I think the question becomes, you know, both sides have moved. Everyone has moved. You know, I think the DUP have moved quite a lot. I think the UK government have moved a bit, and I think Dublin have moved a little. The question is, as we get closer to October, as we get closer to essentially the deadline, which is not October the 31st, but, you know, sometime shortly before the council, right? Because these proposals will need to be worked up. They're not going to write the legal text in that meeting. As we get closer to that moment, does everyone move a bit more because they're sufficiently worried about no deal to do so and they have a sufficient desire to get it all over with? Because if everyone stays where they are as of today, that isn't going to be a deal.
Katie, is a no-deal Brexit still an impetus for action? I mean, Remainers over this side of the channel think that a no-deal is off the table, at least in October. But is it still forcing people to think otherwise because Boris Johnson seems to think that he's not bound by the Benn Bill?
Well, we've seen Downing Street and Boris Johnson say repeatedly that he has no plans to request a delay and extension. I think that message isn't being taken entirely seriously because people don't know how exactly Number 10 plan to get around it. I think one of the reasons, and yesterday we got the non-papers, not the official proposals on the backstop, but non-papers, which is some ideas are floating. But part of the reason
Baby
the government
reports.
Doesn't want to do anything specific yet is they think it's all about timing. And they think as soon as you put your formal suggestions down, it quickly goes to every one of the EU members. You could quickly be trashed, or you could say that, you know, this doesn't work. And I think they would like to have as much pressure as possible when they do it. Now, how does Number 10 plan to get around this delay? There's some talk, and something that James has written about in his column in this week's magazine, that if there were a deal, you could have a situation where part of the grounds of suggesting a deal, which Parliament could vote on, is that the EU would say they're not going to grant any extension. Now, if the EU say they're not going to grant any extension, and this deal is the only thing, that means that the Hillary-Benn bill, in a way, becomes pointless, because all that bill can do is try and force the government to request an extension. It doesn't have anything. It can't force Brussels to say yes to it. If there isn't a deal, I think you are entering different territory as to how you get around that bill. What is the plan? There was some talk a few weeks ago that you could just send two different letters. I think there's a view in Number 10 that whatever they do to get around it, it could likely end up in the courts. But I think once it becomes clear how exactly Boris Johnson, Dominic Cummings and others plan to escape or avoid doing what they say, it might be that Brussels takes it more seriously, or it might be that they think it's just bluster. And I think right now there's a sense that Parliament has shown repeatedly it's against no deal, and I think that is making it more difficult. And figures around Boris Johnson, I mean, they're very quick to say, look, were trying to get a deal, but they believe it has been made much harder because of what they term the surrender bill. And that's what's making it harder to get these concessions.
So it's still all to play for and will kick off in the next month or so. I mean, the other thing that's kicking off today is the global climate strike, where young people, teen activists inspired by Greta Thunberg, are taking to the streets, not going to school, to protest against climate change. James, we'll be seeing that later today as well in central London. What do you make of it?
You can already see it. If you're walking over here, there are already lots of people not at school today in Parliament Square. I think you have to distinguish between two things. You can be impressed by people's level of concern for the environment, but also think that the actual proposals being put forward as part of this climate strike are frankly unworkable. I think what it comes down to is the solution to this challenge is going to have to rely with technology, because I think this idea that you're going to get, I mean, I thought the thing was summed up by Lib Dem conference this week. They want kind of taxes on flying, punitive taxes on flying, but not so punitive they would stop people going on holiday. I mean, which is it? I mean, this is the problem, which is we're not going to get people to go back to living, you know, some kind of far less energy intensive lifestyle by getting them to stop doing things. I think it is about technology. It is about finding a way to use modern technology to reduce emissions and kind of calm global warming down. And I think also at the same time, you know, there are lots of things that we need to be worried about biodiversity and all that stuff, which we also shouldn't be forgetting.
I think on personal lifestyle choices, it's interesting, because if you look at these net carbon targets, you have a situation where lots of people and all the main parties now, I think, do feel the need to put the environment very high up in their agenda. I think Labour conference, we're going to be seeing a big push on the environment over the weekend going into the start of next week. We saw Jo Swinson in her Liberal Democrat speech again try and pitch her party as a party of the environment. Tories have been trying to do that for some time. Jo Swinson was talking about a citizens' assembly to work out how far in terms of people's daily lifestyle they're prepared to go. And that's partly because if you are going to hit these targets, technology is clearly going to be a big factor there. But there are personal choices, such as on flight, such as on diet. And I think that it's very easy for parties to basically talk about the environment. I think that if they are actually going to make public policy the things that you would need as part of the way to getting to that target, it would be really unpopular. You basically would need every single party to agree to these things. Otherwise, you're going to get to a bit of a situation, I think, like social care, and it becomes a political football. So one party goes a bit further out, and then perhaps the other party will say, actually, we're not going to ban how much meat you have. I can't believe this party have done that. And the other thing on it is, how do you actually control or try and limit things like flights or diet in a way which is fair to everyone in society? Because people talk about flight taxes or, you know, having a carbon offsetting tax. Now, that is not going to affect your people like Emma Thompson,
Meghan Markle,
your eco-campaigners who ultimately have so much money that they can afford, or even people like Elton John who say they carbon offset. Now, going a bit of a rant now, but carbon offsetting is a completely questionable practice in terms of whether or not it works in the same sense. Like, you can plant trees, it takes a long time to get it back. But I think One of the things is, then you hear people talking about flight quotas. So you might have a limit on the number of flights everyone can take a year. Now, I think that would be very controversial if any party were to do it. But I think there is a risk of some of these taxes that you only affect the families who, say, would go on a short trip, a cheap flight, Ryanair to Spain. And all these other figures who go in lots of business class flights would get to do it because they wouldn't mind paying the tax and feeling better as a result. So I just think that if we're looking at how parties are going to manage their environment policy in a way, I think there's still areas people find much easier to not get into the detail of.
I think also every party is haunted by what happened in the Australian election. The Australian Labour Party had, you know, what green groups regarded as the most advanced climate change policy of energy taxes and all this, you know, all ready to go. And they thought it was going to deliver them a majority. They ended up suffering a shock defeat in that election. The Australian Liberal Party, which is the party on the centre-right of Australian politics, got re-elected. And everyone basically thinks that's because people quietly in the privacy of the ballot box went and voted the other way because they felt exactly what Katie was just saying.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem, isn't it? You've got this woke sort of echo chamber. You don't think you're able to voice concern on the other direction. Katie, I don't suppose you think much of Labour's plans to plant 1 million trees in hospitals across the UK then?
I've got nothing against people planting trees.
A million trees.
I think this is another example of in theory, there's nothing wrong with planting a million trees. I think it's another example of Labour trying to move into that ground.
Potential lack of ambition. Why not more than a million?
I mean, Rory Stewart likes to plant lots of trees. I think in his Spectator diary he was talking about the weekends. I think, again, on the environment, it's just this thing which is every party has now cottoned onto the fact that people like to say they're environmental and do see climate change as a big issue. But I think there is a thing right now where also every party is happy to say it's a climate change emergency, I think, at this
Labour
point.
Is going to propose a climate change emergency in NHS.
Yeah, but Parliament declared a climate change emergency after lots of pressure. But you can say something's an emergency without actually taking the steps that lots of the campaigners want. So I think we're currently in that point in taking an issue, but no one's actually having the most complex conversations. So I think we will again see Jeremy Corbyn try, because they want to basically take green voters, they want to stop voters going to Lib Dems, trying to push this environmental agenda. But I don't think any party yet has come anything too radical. The most radical party is clearly the Green Party, but I think everyone normally at a general election takes great delight in going through their manifesto and saying how negatively it would affect your life. So I don't know if anyone's going that far yet.
I think we are all hypocrites on this stuff. We all say, "Oh, I think X, Y, and Z," and then it doesn't stop us from going on holiday, or it doesn't stop us from having a steak.
Well, Katie did go to a vegetarian restaurant the other day, by accident.
By accident, I went to a vegetarian, but I did stay in it.
That's good. But then, I mean, I think that would be an extra step to go
but
in.
But then you took an Uber
realise.
Home.
And then
I actually walked home, but thank you. But no, I do think we are guilty, though. I look at my friends and myself, which is saying you're environmental and the thing which is easy for you to do, and the things that are hard and more difficult for you to do, just not really mentioning it. And everyone did have a go at Prince Harry and Meghan Markle for basically saying, they were only going to have two children because that's environmental, which might have been a joke. It was a print interview, so it's hard to tell. But then taking private jets. I mean, I think that's an extreme example of climate hypocrisy. But at this point in time, I think everyone just takes the bits that they want.
I'd like to say that actually, as a millennial, I'm fully committed to tackling climate change, including my vegetarian diet.
Many avocados do you eat, Cindy?
Because they're from Spain. They're not that bad.
But the high intensity in terms of the farming, which means they're actually not particularly good for the environment if we are going to go there.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And you can subscribe to this podcast. You're through all the usual routes, and do give us your review. And tomorrow we will be speaking to Jonathan Reynolds, the Shadow Finance Minister for Labour, on a look ahead to Labour conference. Thanks for listening, and join us again then.